House Bill 5030. Before we start, I would ask that if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, would you please turn it off so that it does not disrupt the hearing. And today we have Rosie back with us. And Rosie the Pig, and by the way, Senator Carter probably won't be with us today as our Sergeant-at-Arms, but I will ask that Representative Greg Smith serves as the Sergeant-at-Arms. Rosie is here to remind us that when one uses acronyms or alphabets, and one must contribute to Rosie the Pig, and at the end of session, the contents of Rosie will go to the Oregon Food Bank to help feed the hungry in our state. So on the one hand, she's there and she would love to be fed. So with that,
Madam Chair,
Representative,
I must say I'm very well prepared to serve in this capacity because I do not know what any of these acronyms mean, and I will be able to pick up on that very quickly.
Well, just to show that the first time you use one, you'll get the right pick. So, Ramona, welcome.
I think I need a bigger notebook.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director for the Department of Human Services. And what we would like to do today is look briefly. Well, first I would point out that you do have two handouts at your seats, and one of those handouts is a copy of our 2001 Child Protective System Report, and the other handout are questions and responses to the questions that have come up over the last 4 days of testimony from children, adults, and families. So you have those for your own use.
Thank you.
Today we wanted to talk for just a little bit about the prioritized list of services, and that you would find behind, I think it says appendix. It does. Item 6 on the tab, appendix. And Jim Neely and I worked together with our managers, with our staff, looking at how we would go about doing a prioritization of services that might be helpful for you all. I know that this will just be one piece of this exercise because I think each group that comes before you will have a prioritized list. And I would say that this is possibly one of the most difficult assignments that we've done because it does force us to look just within the area of public assistance programs and child welfare programs, how would we go about setting priorities. The document looks like this for those that are still, and it's in that Appendix 6.
Appendix 6.
Yeah, in the book.
I didn't have it in the book.
And
it's in front of the green, or green tab for most of you. Behind the green tab is the community human services piece that we'll get into later.
There we go.
Okay.
And basically, and this is more detailed and we'll go into because we did use our budget and all of the items you see in this list of 47 items, we did categorize by budget. But what we try to do is approach this from a philosophy that the first thing that we think we would have to preserve in terms of our functions in children, adults, and families is the safety of children. And therefore, you see the number one item is Child Protective Services. And again, that's from a philosophy that safety has to be the thing that we want to preserve for families. And how we go about that is what we might would discuss, but the fact that we want to make sure safety is foremost in our minds. We then talked about, well, what are those services then that might actually help keep children safe so that children don't have to enter the system or enter state custody? And there you will see TANF client benefits. Okay, $5 for Rosie. Temporary assistance for needy families. Didn't take long, did it? Temporary assistance for families because we know that about 60% of the children who actually come into the foster care system were at one time eligible for public assistance. Either they were receiving public assistance or they could have if someone had applied. So we see that as a family preservation program and trying to keep families safe and keep children safe within those families. A third item is the foster care program, because that is a part of the Child Protective Services system. It would be impossible to try to do child protection without having some place to have children enter if they couldn't be safely within their own families. And then the fourth is the food stamps benefits program. And again, we approach that conversation from the idea that these are things that keep families perhaps from having to use more intensive services and would keep children fed and within their own families. That was kind of our thinking about the first large categories of services. And if you drop on down the list, you will see things such as system of care and adoption assistance. The truth is that with child protection and foster care, those are the things that would preserve children, keep them safe. Unfortunately, we could end up with a situation if we did not preserve adoption work, and many of these categories you will see relate to adoptions, children would simply remain in foster care. Some of those children might go back home, as you heard in testimony earlier, but unfortunately, I think our numbers for children who need to be adopted would probably reflect the loss of adoption services as we work on down this list. So I think with that, I would give you a few minutes maybe to just look at the list, see if you have particular questions. But again, that's kind of the approach we took. Employment-related daycare, we also see as, and as we've talked about this more recently, we might would actually move that one up in the list, because we think as families take advantage of temporary assistance to needy families, that program, they're also going to need to require daycare. And so that's another kind of family preservation service for us. That's kind of the thoughts that we had as we went through this. Given how the time frame in which we put this together, we did not try to associate FTE, full-time equivalents, with this at this point. But Jean Thorne indicated that she knows that that may be a question later when, as we come to the department-wide services piece. And all of these various programs, of course, would not just have a children, adults, and families FTE or full-time equivalent, but could also have staff in the field associated with these various services. For example, if we were not going to do child protection, then we would no longer need child protective service staff in the field.
Right. Would you elaborate on 13 and what the legal assistance, including Multnomah District Attorney and Department of Justice category is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that particular item is how we do our termination of parental rights on cases for children who cannot go back home, and we're going to, the goal becomes adoption. Multnomah County, we have a different arrangement with them, and they do the termination of parental rights. For all other counties, the termination of parental rights legal assistance work is done by the Department of Justice.
Is there any questions? You have another category, special contracts. It's number 21.
Madam Chair, special contracts. Those are contracts we have for emergency residential care for children, children who need to come into care for at least a short period of time. And we have arrangements around the state with certain providers to provide that level of care.
That's not a part of the foster care.
It's associated with foster care, but it is not included in item 3 up at the top. In other words, if we no longer had the special contracts, those children would have to be accommodated in number 3 if we still had number 3 at the top.
And there's an acronym, well, it's a federal program, and I think that must be, that's the post-adoption that we heard about yesterday, number 42.
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, that's the Oregon Post-Adoption Resource Center.
Those dollars flow through you and then down to the, or are they direct?
We collect the federal dollars, and then we contract the services and adoptions to the private providers.
And explain to me level 7 county programs.
Madam Chair,
item number
37 is those are funds that go to the Commission on Children and Families, and that is to care for a category of children that's generally teenagers, children in the community. And level 7, I guess it predates me, but I guess that goes back to a system of levels of care, perhaps from the 80s, when some distinction had to be made about which children are most needy. Younger children were considered the most needy, and the level 7 children were the children who were approximately 12 years of age and older.
But they're passed through from you to the commission?
Yes, Madam Chair, they are.
Madam Chair, when we saw the Commission on Children and Families budget, this is the, I believe they call it the Youth Investment Grant Stream. It flows from DH, the Department of Human Services, to the Commission on Children and Families at the state level, and then down to the local counties for locally delivered services for its at-risk or homeless youth. The level 7, as Ramona indicated, refers to a historical similar to how elderly and disabled services, long-term care, have survival levels 1 through 14, 15, whatever. At one point, the children's services programs were categorized with similar levels 1 through 7 or 8. And level 7 was this group or subset of children and youth that it was felt that the county programs could deliver services more effectively than the Children's Protective Services system.
Pomona, would it be helpful if, and I'm thinking about alcohol and drug and mental health services specifically, where your workers or caseworkers have needs to access those services, if those services were prioritized to where we could be assured that DHS's clients had first priority, would that be helpful for your workers as they attempt to work with the families? And help me with that concept.
Madam Chair, I think that would be extremely beneficial. I think on item 15, one of our efforts there, the family support teams, this whole effort around alcohol and drug, as you've heard over the last 4 days of testimony, this is a critical issue, and we are working internally to see if there's any way we can set some priorities for families whose children have been gone into foster care or families who are active Child Protective Service cases around that. But certainly I think the agency, there will be a number of priorities that will come before you regarding needs for treatment, but I think that we would agree that the needs for children and children who are coming into state custody, for us that is a priority.
I was just recalling when Kate Turan was here that, and I came back in as a legislator, that was one of the issues that she had talked to me about, that we really do need to begin to target and set some priorities, because approximately 70% or greater of the families that you're dealing with have alcohol and drug issues, and yet I don't think we're focusing in to make sure that the dollars that are over here are being able to target with the population that you're serving within service of children and families.
And, Madam Chair, that does continue to be an issue. And I think on the one day that you were unable to be with us, I did talk about Judge Pratt in Ontario wanting to make sure that we recognize that he has similar problems with methamphetamine, even in the rural part of the state, and that he's very concerned about making sure that these services are available to families, and that he wanted us to be sure to know it was not just a phenomenon of the I-5 corridor. So it is a statewide problem.
He must have. Well, it's an issue that we're grappling with in Oregon that none of us can be very proud of.
Right.
Oregon has exploded with the methamphetamine drug problem.
Is there any questions?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Ms. Foley, I know that we're looking at a prioritized list here, but I'm not clear on what the criteria were to arrive at the rankings. Is there a corresponding document or piece of information that would help me link that?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, I would not hold this out as being scientific. This was a coming together of all of our managers in children, adults, and families, and simply an effort to go through the list, go through it additional times to try to determine where we thought, and again, around those large caveats around safety of children first, and then trying to maintain children within their own families, and what are the programs that help us to do that. And then if children can't be in their families and do become foster children, what are the things that we might see as outcomes, including adoption? So we use those large caveats. But this was a new exercise for us going through this process. It's a helpful exercise, but it's also a distressing exercise, as I think you'll hear from other clusters who come to testify, because it really does force us to think in terms of larger policy issues. Madam Chair, as you were saying, how do we set our priorities as a state? And this is just a small view of priorities you will be hear about from the Department of Human Services.
It will. Thank you, Madam Chair. It would help me a great deal if I could see the caveats, as you put it, in written form, as well as hearing them orally. I need some time to really reflect on what you're saying and relate it to the rankings that we have.
Okay. Madam Chair and Senator Gordon, we'd be glad to do that. And then on the right-hand side, I would point out the other thing we looked at is we went through and looked at which regulation and which federal or state law actually controls for these various parts of our organization. And as you can see, most of these are housed in federal, state law, or administrative rule. And so any of these can have some fiscal impact as we think about what we would reduce. But we'll be glad to give you a one-page document that just sort of explains what I've said as the criteria that we started with.
That would be helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
For the members, all of the committees have been, at the direction of the co-chairs, have requested that the agencies give us a priority listing. And it's a part of that priority listing to denote where the funding streams are coming from, so that we can, as we go get ready to go into work session, that we will have a clear understanding of the federal funding implications as well as the general fund implications, and to try to assist us in our deliberations when we get into work session. The other piece that will be coming forward is the piece on FTE and those impacts and implications on programs, so that we can be able to make some, hopefully, some good judgments as we go through the budget. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. Would it be possible, and if I'm the only one that this would be of benefit to, let's not do it, but looking at your prioritized list, if we could have those categorized by the broad program lists that mm-hmm. you have on page one mm-hmm. of the tab three, mm-hmm. would be helpful to know just where these are lumped.
Madam Chair, and Senator Morris, we can certainly do that. We can do a matrix that shows which part of the program area these are associated with.
If that's something else.
Well, I think that's great, because it helps me understand.
Representative Smith.
Beg your pardon, Madam Chair. That would be great to help me understand, looking at it from a broader level, what we're doing here within this department. Wonderful question.
And, Madam Chair, we will take that recommendation and ask our successors in this process to do the same thing with this prioritized list, so you'll have that as the other testimony comes forward.
Thank you. Any other questions? Continue.
Well, that concludes our presentation on the prioritized list of services. And I think at this point, Sheila, I think we're ready to move to Community Human Services.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we're shifting gears now. It's still the same budget bill, House Bill 5030, a different line item in the budget bill, but we're moving to the community human services piece. As we get into the agency material, it's still in the same brown binder that you've had, so they've only got one binder for two program areas, which is good, I think. The detailed budget material is in the black binder in front of you. And we have prepared our standard orientation and background material for this section. Then we'll try to get through the program area overview today, and then the summary of the governor's recommended budget by Pam Teschner of the Department of Administrative Services. And then the detailed program area discussion will happen on Monday and Tuesday of next week. So hopefully you brought with you the memorandums that were delivered to your office yesterday afternoon. I hope you got those. If not, I think I have one extra copy. And as we go through this, there are two distinct parts of community human services in terms of significant budget discussion. The first, of course, is the field staffing, which we'll talk about, and then the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, which Cindy Jones has. So starting on the front page of the memo basically refers you to our overview slides, which we have prepared. So let's turn to the second piece of paper. And this is just a summary of what this budget area is comprised of. As I mentioned, it's the state program support staff for the self-sufficiency and child welfare programs. It also has the department's field staff serving seniors and people with disabilities. It has the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services staff in the field as part of this program support staff. And then it also has the Central Oregon Health Plan Eligibility Office that processes applications for the Oregon Health Plan. There is also a fraud investigations function, quality control, and then a unit that maintains child care provider registries and makes payments to those qualified child care providers. And then, as mentioned, part of this is the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, which we'll talk about in a little more detail later. Federal funds make up over half of this budget. Basically, these are the same federal funding streams that we talked about in the children, adults, and families area and that you'll hear in the senior people with disabilities area. In some cases, the match for program support or administrative functions is at a slightly lesser rate in terms of federal participation. It's often 50-50 state, 50% state, 50% federal, instead of a higher programmatic match rate. So you'll see a little bit smaller share of federal funds in this area than in the actual program services areas. The next slide shows of this budget overall, most of the funding goes to the program support piece, which is the field staffing. The Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services is about 6% of the budget, and then there's a central administration piece, which includes some of those quality assurance functions that I talked about earlier. That's about 4% of this budget. The next slide just shows that, again, the revenue and the budget drivers for this particular budget unit mirror the revenue and budget drivers for the programs that it is delivering services for. Major federal funding sources include the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Block Grant, Medicaid, some Medicare money, foster care and adoption assistance, food stamps, and then vocational rehabilitation services, what's called the Basic 110 grant. And as with the program areas, again, the state and federal policy and program mandates, changes in funding levels, things that affect client eligibility and staffing practices obviously affect this budget unit. Particularly caseload growth affects this budget unit in the sense that field staffing is in many program areas tied to caseload growth or declines, so that there are staffing standards in those programs that the budget reflects a certain number of caseworkers for a certain level of cases. And the agency will talk in more detail about that, but the fluctuations in caseload obviously have an impact on the field staff. Then the next set of overview material refers to the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and I'll let Cindy Jones cover those.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Jones. The Office of Vocational Rehab Services is responsible for the administration of vocational rehabilitation services, which is a federally mandated program. They also integrate vocational rehabilitation services throughout 56 locations with other services in the service delivery area. It's made up of three major programs: the Vocational Rehab Services, Rehabilitation Services, Youth Transition Program, and Supported Employment Services. During the 2001-03 Biennium 2 programs were eliminated, the Independent Living Program, which was the infrastructure program, as well as the Shelter Services Program. The Office of Vocational Rehab Services special payments are broken out by the three major programs. The Vocational Rehabilitation Services is 80%. Special payments go to that program. The Youth Transition Program, there are 18% of the funds go to that program. And Supported Employment Program, 2% of special payments go to that program. The budget drivers for vocational rehabilitation services are continuing changes in the federal level, including the reauthorization of Rehabilitation Act and Workforce Investment Act. There's increased competitions for fewer jobs, and there are other budget cuts that have reduced partners who have the ability to provide needed support services as well.
What's the federal-state match ratio for both of you?
Madam Chair, I believe, and Sheila, you might want to back me up on this, it's the $3.70 to that 110.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the other way to think about it is almost 80% state to 20%. 80% federal to 20% state. Right, I see. I knew I had it backwards. But it is a higher federal participation rate than almost all of the other programs in the department. On the back page of the cover memo, we two-sided this, of course, to be efficient. We've listed just a couple of issues or special challenges that, as we go through these budget hearings, we think the subcommittee should keep in the front of their minds. One is, of course, the departmental reorganization. It's had a significant impact on how the field office has been structured, and also changed the expectations regarding service delivery for those field staff. And trying to manage that reorganization, even at the best of times, would be challenging. But particularly in this budget environment, I think it is even more challenging than what it would otherwise be. And then, of course, we note that changes in policy, program requirements, funding levels, all of that needs to get communicated from the central office to the field staff so that they are able to deliver the appropriate services to clients and continue to deliver it efficiently. So we think those are the issues that are worth noting as we start into this budget. So we'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, we'll turn it over back over to the agency for the program area overview.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, what would be included in the central administration activities? Are there any flow-through funds that go through that account?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I believe that most of the budget, most of the central administration, there's the administrative piece, if you will, the director or the assistant director for this program area and some central office staff. There are also some policy people working in that particular environment, but the bulk of the staffing is with the fraud investigations unit and the quality control and then the child care provider unit. So it's hands-on program support. I don't believe that there are flow-through funds in the sense that there are in the children, adult, and families budget, for instance.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I draw attention to that is that if the FTEs, in fact, are 101 and the central administration cost is 24 $1,381,000, that would put this in a very high cost per FTE category relative to other agencies.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, again, the budgeted cost here would not reflect just the FTE cost. It would also include the special payments out, for example, to the child care providers themselves.
That was the
question. Okay. I thought you were.
I said flow through.
Okay. Yeah, there are payments out. There would also be some contractual payments that are included in that.
That's what I was after. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Burns, the acting deputy for Community Human Services. I heard about Rosie, and my first reaction was I'm always up for a challenge, but then being a realist, I decided I probably wouldn't make 60 seconds, so it's here.
Rosie appreciates it.
Community Human Services is that part of the department that's responsible for the determination of eligibility and the delivery of benefits for needy individuals and families throughout the state of Oregon. Community Human Services includes the statewide processing center in Salem, which handles all of the Oregon Health Plan applications and ongoing cases, and includes all of the field offices of the department throughout the state that are organized into 16 service delivery areas that were created by the reorganization 2 years ago. Community Human Services includes, as has been referenced earlier, all of vocational rehabilitation staff and services. It includes all of the public welfare self-sufficiency services, which includes temporary assistance to needy families, food stamps, daycare, jobs program, all of the child welfare services that include adoptions, foster care, protective services, and it includes about 15% of the services and staff to seniors and people with disabilities. The other 85% are offered by area agencies on aging and county governments through contracts with the Central Office of Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Jerry, where are the counties or the that are served by the state and not the area agencies?
They're primarily the rural, Madam Chair, they're primarily the rural counties. Most of the urban counties are through area agencies on aging and the county, local county contracts.
Is that because the counties or there just isn't the abilities within those counties to?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. The seniors and people with disabilities will be one of the clusters following, and we'll have all of that history and background.
Okay, thank you.
The 16 service delivery areas are responsible for linking the programs within the department with one another and for creating partnerships with community agencies, nonprofits, and local governments. The goal of within the department, the goal here is to create integrated delivery systems where clients who have multiple needs can avoid multiple complicated and confusing plans and services. The administrative structure for each of the 16 service delivery areas is roughly the same, although the staffing varies with the size of the service delivery area. But essentially, there is a service delivery area manager who has the overall coordination responsibilities, and then some number of program managers that have program-specific expertise in child welfare or the self-sufficiency programs of public welfare or seniors and people with disabilities. And they essentially have the responsibility of the day-to-day supervision over those areas. On page 4 is the mission and 2-year plan for Community Human Services. Essentially, I guess what I would add to this is that I think the mission statement is accurate around comprehensive and seamless delivery system. The 2-year plan reinforces our desire to create that system. I think the other thing I would add to that is that over the next 2 years, one of our additional goals is really restoring the integrity of the individual program, some of which have been compromised by the focus, singular focus we've had on integration over the last 2 years. And that's a brief overview.
Are there any questions? I have a question because we dramatically changed when we did the reorganization, and I guess I'd like to have some sense as to is it working, how well is it working, how much work needs to be done even in light of this this environment that we're in. And I know in moving towards the issue of not having to do multiple plans, but having particularly focusing on whether or not we're moving any closer to not having people shuffled around in the system. Can you enlighten this group on where we are?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I couldn't give you percentages, but I can give you sort of an overall sense from conversations with folks. I think that universally what our staff and managers would say is that there is a much better understanding about all of the programs of the department that has occurred as a result of the integration efforts. And because of that, there is a much greater likelihood that we're going to have coordinated services, that we're going to make referrals for clients who potentially could be eligible for services that are offered by another program in the department. I think that particularly in smaller areas, more rural areas, they are much more likely by this point to have processes in place where they can actually identify cases or families that are receiving multiple services. And in some of those areas have reached, certainly in most of those areas, they have coordinated case plans. I'm not sure that any area in the state actually has a single case plan for an individual, but they have collaborative staffings that they do for those families. This has been one of the things that Gene Thorne has asked kind of across the department in each of the service delivery areas as well as all the advocacy groups, is to go through a process of identifying what has worked in integration, what could work, and what do we need to revisit. And we've been doing a lot of that in the field, part of what I've been just reviewing with you, some of the stuff that we've gotten from some of our senior managers.
So we're not quite at that, completed that analysis yet of what's working and what's not working.
Madam Chair, no, this is a process where we're actually trying to collect this not only from internally but from kind of external sources, advocates, and other agencies as well. So it'll be several months putting all that together.
Where are we in the data systems or the integrated data systems that would eventually allow us to get to a one focused intake system?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can't say that from my experience being a service delivery manager for most of the last 2 years that I saw it on the horizon. Now, the folks in our administrative services would have a better sense about what the capacity and potential is in terms of the timeline.
Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, thank you. The list of prioritization, or the prioritization list that we looked at previously, does that include anything from the Community Human Services?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, yes, what it would do is, as we work through that list and add the full-time equivalents, the column that says FTE, we would be taking each of those program areas and accommodating how many people we have in Community Human Services who are performing those functions.
Okay.
Follow-up.
That was not quite my question.
I'm sorry.
The Community Human Services activities, are they included in that list?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, yes, they are.
They are.
Yes.
Follow-up question. And this is a global question. All of the programs that we have, there seems to be an overlap in terms of the people and the focus they're being addressed within DHS. Has there been a mapping exercise that maps all of the programs and identifies wherein they overlap.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris,
help you in your prioritization.
We have such a map, and that was one of the things that we developed during the reorganization discussion to see. I think if you go to the fine tuning, there are about 200 programs total across the department, and we actually have several working groups to look at what are those program areas that cross over. Where are there opportunities? Employment is one of those. We found that in not only is employment a goal in vocational rehabilitation, but employment's a goal, obviously, with temporary assistance to needy families. And so there are several of these programs that will have functions within them that are similar functions. And what we've tried to do is align work groups as part of the reorganization structure to make sure that we are talking with each other and communicating so that there's not any duplication or overlap in those.
Follow. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you anticipate any cost savings with this activity, or is your work reflected in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I think our work is reflected in the governor's budget, and I think the cost savings potentially are how we are able to do our integrated efforts to achieve goals with families earlier in the system rather than the number of families we have that end up needing very intrusive services. So I think it's a long-range goal.
Senator Morris, the last session we passed out Jerry was alluding to the reorganization, which totally said to the agency that you will focus on bringing your services together to not only reduce duplication, but to have a system where you're integrating in the work together. We took and carved out of that I can't remember how many dollars now, that reduced a whole layer of managers, if you will, because we basically said instead of having a manager for adult and family service, then service children, families, and what have you, you had one manager for that whole cluster. So they're going through this process now of having to try to implement what we directed them to do. And we also said to them that we wanted them to have in the IT piece of it, that they would be able to have a case that could follow the individual inside the system so that you wouldn't have nine cases, you would have one. That piece is on hold because of budgetary constraints. The dollars that were put in for the IT system was also taken away. So the agency has spent the last 2 years in trying to implement the reorg as we have directed. They've come to a place, and that's where I asked the question, where they really need to begin to assess whether or not what they've done to date is effective with the clients that they're serving. And so they're continuing with this kind of analysis, I think, and Sheila may want to add on to what we've done. But this is a direction that this body has given them to not only look at from the standpoint if they have a one-stop shop, if you will, in some communities where that's affordable, or they can do it, but some systems to where you're actually bringing the cluster of services to bear on the individual family.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, just to put some dollars to this, in the 2001-2003 budget, there was an expectation that the department would save at least $10 million from the reorganization. The budget was reduced by $4 million, so in effect, those savings were grabbed off the top, and the department never got those monies. The additional $6 million was expected to be found internally, and then the department was to be able to redirect those to supporting the reorganization. For example, the information systems pieces, some additional training, things like that needed to be done, the redevelopment of the federal cost allocation plan, all of those pieces that needed to reflect the reorganization and support it were to be helped along with the $6 million of savings that was to be reinvested. as we were going through the biennium and the department was looking at budget reductions along with everyone else, a lot of those savings were siphoned off, if you will, for other savings purposes for part of the budget reduction so that that money wasn't available to reinvest. And I don't have an up-to-date total, but we can talk about it when we get to the department-wide stuff. But I believe that where they are in terms of reinvestment is somewhere down maybe at most $2 to $3 million out of that original $6 million that was expected to be saved and then reinvested. So out of the total $10 million initial expectation, we took $4 million off the top. That was saved, if you will, for 0103 already. The $6 million in savings that the department was supposed to find, they found some of it, or had to reallocate the savings elsewhere as part of budget reduction. So in terms of a total reinvestment, they're nowhere near the $6 million that was originally anticipated to be reinvested to support the reorganization. So I hope that made sense.
Madam Chair. With all due respect, it's not real clear to me.
Okay.
Maybe I'm the only one. But if we were to look at the before and now the after, how would it change in FTE? How would it change in organization by department? And how would it change in cost? And has that been formulated, the before and the after?
Okay.
That's kind of where I would.
Yeah, Senator Morris, I would say that our office has certainly not done that, and the reason would be that it's not just a question of before reorganization and after reorganization. It's before reorganization, after budget reductions during the 0103 biennium, after caseload adjustments during the 0103 biennium, after additional adjustments such as the Oregon Health Plan waiver, Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver expansion, so it would be difficult to get to an apples and oranges comparison. From a budget standpoint, there was at least $4 million of savings coming out. In terms of FTE, we can look at where the FTE was before and where the FTE is now. We don't have a direct line that says this FTE was here and now it's over here, or this one was eliminated or this one is not. We don't have that in a short summary form, and it would take some work to pull that together.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Would it be possible to get information that would show the percentage of reductions to each of these appropriations that your department recommended prior to Measure 28 to see how they line up with your prioritized list today?
I believe, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I would probably either yield to Sheila Baker on that or to
Margie.
Not today, but just in the coming days, because this is the prioritized list, and I'd just be interested in seeing how your department prioritized this when we were looking at having to balance prior to Measure 28.
Sheila?
Madam Chair, I think it would be useful to clarify the question, and before I try and clarify the question, let me just talk a little bit. The department's prioritized list was prepared based on the co-chair's direction that subcommittees look at what the departments felt were their programmatic priorities in terms of a context for assessing further reductions. These lists were not available or were not prepared as we went through the interim reductions during the interim. That said, I think that there would be a lot of consistency between where the department and the governor and the legislature tried to protect particular pieces of programs as we went through that exercise. But
is it inaccurate, Madam Chair? Is it inaccurate that, and I'm just trying to grasp this because I just want to understand, is it inaccurate that this body directed the departments to go in internally try and find the savings that they could find as a result of Measure 28? what I'm trying to find out is I just want to know if these priorities line up with what was proposed before Measure 28.
Before Measure 28, if you will, and I'm not, 5,500 is what you're alluding to. 5,100, I'm sorry. 5,100 is what you are alluding to. And this body did not, and you know, the governor's authority was to do a 5,100. We did, because this body was also involved in some of the prioritizations in 5,100, if you will recall. And all through the process leading up to 5,100, you know, between the group of five and all the others, this body was involved in making some of those decisions. This particular priority list is one that the co-chairs and your chair here has requested that the agency provide us with, in so that we can get a handle on the current status of what if we had to rank and make some cuts, programmatic cuts, not across the board cuts, but looking at asking the agency in their best judgment, where would they go? And that's the distinction between, some of the distinction between what we did in the last legislative session and the special session. If you're asking the question of if the agency, as a result of 5,100, took specific cuts based on the direction of the governor, that's a different, distinct question.
All I'm trying to find out, and perhaps I'm not asking my question correctly, in 5,100, there are very broad reductions made, and it was my understanding that the legislature was going to allow the departments to determine where they thought the savings could best be found. And what I'm trying to figure out is what were their recommendations for the best way to find those savings, and how does that recommendation match up with this recommendation today?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I think what the agency can do is show you against that prioritized list where the House Bill 5,100 reductions have been taken. So, for example, on foster care on the list, were there reductions taken there? On adoption assistance, what were the reductions taken there? So you can see where the reductions fall out along that list. I think that's something that we could get to relatively easily. And then you'd be able to see how those reductions lined up against those priorities, keeping in mind, as Ramona said, that this was an exercise of looking at varying factors and that the reductions were to be general fund reductions. And so a number of those things that are lower priority on that list that may be other fund or federal fund, either entirely or predominantly, wouldn't have been, even if they were lower priority on that list, wouldn't have been a place that the department would have looked for a reduction because it wouldn't have saved them any general fund. So there wouldn't have been a purpose in reducing that. But I think we could get, using a similar format of that list and then looking at where the reductions fell in that program categorization, if that would be helpful.
That would be, and then perhaps after that I can set up a separate meeting so I can go through it and feel comfortable with what we're doing.
It might be helpful. You may want to go back and take a look at the 5,100 issues.
I'm going, yes.
And also go back and look at what we did during the five special sessions, and that will kind of bring you up to what we've done with this particular agency.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
I appreciate the representative's question because it goes back to, for me, it goes back to a question I asked earlier about criteria. Mm-hmm. What are the criteria being considered now as we look at this ranking? And we've gone through several iterations now of prioritizing and ranking, and the question and concern I have is consistency. You know, are we continuing to apply the same criteria, or does it shift? And if it shifts, how does it shift? And, you know, whose principles, whose values are being assigned each time we do it? So, you know, I hear Representative Smith asking a question about consistency, which is what I want to get at as well. So I appreciate the question.
I think that the you know, Ramona will give us the overarching principles, and it may be helpful if the overarching principles of the department, and I'll talk to Jean about it, that each agency, when they come before us, you know, I think this is the first time that they've had to really come back to us in this fashion, and maybe we can work from that base. But all of you that are on subcommittees, every subcommittee is being asked of their agencies to come back with prioritized lists mm-hmm. in order to give some guideposts, some guidelines for this body to help in crafting the budget. Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I just would like to just kind of update us to remember Jean Horn's comments when she first came, and that is that this is like a new baby. She inherited a department that is totally transitioning from a change that was not even in place no more than 2 years, isn't it right? A two-year period of time. And so what they're now trying to do is shift the department back in a way so that the field is very much in congruence in terms of knowledge of where the administrators are and what they want to happen for the department. So probably, Senator, you're going to see a lot of inconsistencies due to change, because they changed in 2001, and now they're changing back again in 2003 because they saw where 2001 could not work. And so I'm sure that we're going to see some transition because of changes in governors and also in leadership at the department.
Madam Chair, what may be helpful, too, is when we were doing the 5100 discussion, we did produce some bullet points that kind of captured why we made the choices we made. And as Sheila Baker indicated, it was very much driven by where was most of the general fund. And that is different than the criteria, the exercise we used here. Yes. So perhaps those two things together would give you a better sense of where we've tried to work this through.
Our instructions, and I'm going to step back, our instructions from the co-chairs was to talk about fundamentally health, safety, and we're asking them to give to us, not from a budgetary standpoint, but more from a programmatic and a standpoint of what are the most important programs. If you had to say, if we have to eliminate something mm-hmm. in that order, what would it be? And that's different from coming at it from a budget driver that says we're going to cut 10%. So what, and all the agencies have been requested to do that, so that we can begin to look at from a standpoint of the value of the most needy, the most vulnerable. And I think I gave each of you the basic principles of what this committee would be looking at. And I think if you keep that in focus, and that was shared with the agency. So, but I think we can provide you with that information, Representative Smith, and this panel of just what the overarching principles are, Ramona. And I
yes, please do. Thank you.
Continue, please.
At this point, we thought we would have Pam discuss the governor's budget, and then we will go back to the details in the community human services piece you have in front of you.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, I am Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management. And the document I'm going to go through, I hope, is somewhere close to you. On the front of it, it says 2003-05. That's it, governor's budget. And it's got a kind of a spiral notebook look to it. The first page, which is actually numbered page 2, is a table that follows the development of the budget across time, and I will provide some detail about what's behind this as we get further into it, but again, to remind you, this budget was being pulled together in December, and when the forecast was released, we quickly implemented the reductions that were needed in order to balance to that revenue forecast, as was mentioned yesterday. For the most part, as you'll see later, the general fund increase is driven primarily by caseload increases and also personal services costs that rolled up from 2001-03. The drop in other funds is kind of a combined effect of a variety of things, including drops in the Child Care Development Fund monies, criminal fines and assessment account monies, the Senate Bill 288, in which the Department of Consumer and Business Services transferred money for rehabilitative facilities, that is going away in June. So there's a number of things that can account for that drop in other funds. And the increase in positions, we will look at the specifics of what is behind the position FTE increases. Page 3 is a pie chart of the total budget, and this is going to look real familiar because it's very, very similar to what Sheila has already shared. Yes.
Pam, when you come back and we get into detail on the FTEs, would you separate them out by management and field so that there's a delineation between the field FTEs and management FTEs?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to provide that for you. I don't have a split by field versus management today.
But when we come back to get into detail, that would be helpful.
Okay.
And it would also be helpful to give us of what the drivers are, you know, whether it's the food stamp that
right.
in field
right.
And
yes, okay,
thank you.
Okay, and as Sheila mentioned on page 3 here, the federal funds are primarily, I believe, a little over $88 million is temporary assistance for needy families. A chunk of it is Medicaid and Medicare, vocational rehabilitation services, child welfare, food stamps. That's primarily your federal funds. Again, this is just a very high-level, cluster-wide picture of the governor's budget. That increase, as I mentioned already and from that table, that is the increases driven primarily by caseload growth and the staffing that is needed that's associated with that caseload and the position actions and compensation changes. This, as you've already heard from Jerry and you're going to hear in more detail, this particular cluster, Community Human Services, is the delivery arm of the department, delivering benefits and services that promote self-sufficiency and child welfare, as you've heard a lot already, foster care, adoption assistance, child protective services. It's the vocational rehabilitation and health and independence of Oregonians through numerous field locations throughout the state. And Jerry talked a little bit about the service delivery areas, and I believe there's 16 of them across the state. Page 5 takes that same total funds budget and looks at it by the three program areas or three units within this cluster. Again, it's the same graph that Sheila had shared, and as you can see, 90% of the budget is going to program support, which again is self-sufficiency, child welfare, vocational rehabilitation, seniors and people with disabilities, and Oregon Health Plan eligibility determination. Page 6, this pie chart splits it by the category, budget categories, personal services versus services and supplies versus special payments. And again, you can see that the majority of the budget is going out in this particular cluster in personal services because this is the service delivery arm of the department. This is where the FTE are located that actually are the frontline staff providing service, delivering benefits. This, from here on, from page 7 on, it kind of walks you through the development of the governor's budget, and it gives you some benchmarks at the beginning there. What you're probably more interested in, and it's more significant as we go on into some of the packages on page 8, The 030 package is the package that the department will build inflation into the budget for services and supplies, for example. When we were balancing to the December revenue forecast, this is where we grabbed some money in order to balance. And for the community human services, what I did was take the general fund inflationary increases, and that was close to $1 million, just slightly under $1 million, that you'll see in a little bit later package where that piece of the inflation was eliminated. The 040 package is the one that we have been talking a lot about, the mandated caseload.
Senator Carter.
Pam, can we go back to 010?
Oh, sir.
On page 7. I'm wondering, it appears to me that $700,000 is high for overtime and from total funds, and $300,000 from general fund. That's $1 million. Tell us about that.
You know, the 010 package factors in a combined, and I'm not sure what the department's load of temporary staff are. I don't know how many people we're talking about there, which would probably be the driver of that, or how much overtime is logged. Details, I am not aware of the details behind.
Could you provide that?
But yes, I'll look into that. Yeah. 010 package.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, again, we're page 8, the mandated caseload package. And in this cluster, the mandated caseloads are food stamps being the biggest one, child welfare, and you can see that's broken down into foster care adoption assistance and supportive remedial daycare. And on the senior side, Medicaid, long-term care, and supplemental income program, those are the mandatory caseloads where there is associated field staff in this cluster that's providing service. The increase for the 2003-05 budget added $30 million general fund and $57 million total funds associated with the staffing increases that are needed to support the rapid growth in those areas. It translates into approximately a little over 600 positions. FTE, I believe, is about 570 FTE associated with the caseload growth for that package. The next page, the 050 is a fund shift, and there's two things going on in that package where there's a shift of $1.2 million from other funds and federal funds into general fund, and one of those reasons is a slight increase to the federal Medicaid match rate. The Medicaid match rate was 59.66%, and it has gone up to 60.16%, and that created an increase in funds that was shifted into general fund. And then in addition to that, there are some block grants that are capped, federal grants, and the federal funds themselves are capped, and the department provides the budget for personal services and services and supplies to support those programs. So that is the inflationary increases in services and supplies for those federally capped programs. Then, as the policy packages lay out kind of what happened through the sessions, and the one of the most significant ones, package 083 is the October 2002 emergency board, where there was the approval for the Oregon Health Plan 2. That implementation added $4.3 million total funds and $2.1 million in general fund, which is about 45 positions were added with that money.
Yeah.
Package 084 is the November 2002 emergency board, and there was actually a decrease of $3.9 million total funds and $2.4 million general fund because of a readjustment to their forecasts. Forecasts earlier in the year had predicted a more aggressive growth in temporary assistance to needy families and food stamp caseloads, and as time went on and the actuals began to roll in, they readjusted that forecast down slightly, and it created a need to decrease the funds. The package 091 on page 10 is the fifth special session, section 2. And here we had reductions that were made that resulted from the failure of ballot measure 28. 10.6 million total funds were cut and 6.2 million general fund. These are the major reductions. This isn't the comprehensive list of every dollar, but this hits the major areas. And as we've heard, the elimination of the independent living infrastructure cut 1.3 million from the general fund. The elimination of the sheltered services program cut $900,000 from the general fund. And then the cuts in the cluster seniors and people with disabilities, those program cuts translated into this cluster because of the field staff that, as a result of those program cuts, there was an elimination of 83 positions in this cluster in field staff. And those reductions came out of Medicaid long-term care, the elimination of the general assistance program, and the elimination of the medically needy program that had the ripple effect of, you know, the reduction of field staff from those cuts. The last package there, additional program reductions.
Senator Carter.
Yes. Oh, Sam, before you go to the next one, maybe Ramona needs to answer this. But starting at line 5 to 17, I understand the higher end of that. But isn't line 5, is that people in critical care? Mm-hmm. Elimination of levels 5 through 17 for Medicaid.
I don't know what level.
We, with the restoration action that we took, mm-hmm. it's back to level 11.
11, okay. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks, ma'am.
Okay. So, package 092, we actually made some adjustments. Instead of typically that package is for additional reductions. In this case, there was this is where we restored the system of care funds. To remember, and actually the next page gives you a bullet on that, the governor lessened Measure 28 cuts to child welfare by adding back $5 million in general fund. And we, in children, adults, and families, we already looked at some of the funds went there in flex funds, $3 million went there, but here, $2 million of the $5 million went into community human services to add back service delivery staff, and that bought back 29 staff. And then this is, so with that $2 million addition, then I subtracted out the general fund inflationary increases that I mentioned earlier from package 030.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Pam.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you turn to page 5, which is the organization chart, I'll resume a description of community human services. The organization chart shows the current structure of community human services, which essentially, as you can see, has Ramona Foley as the interim assistant director, and then of course she has children, adults, and families as a whole other cluster that she also manages. I'm shown as the deputy, and then there are three areas under this position. The first of those is the 16 local service delivery areas in the statewide processing center. In the middle is the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, which are those central office staff that are available to support the vocational rehabilitation services offered through the 13 branch offices of vocational rehabilitation throughout the state. And then the two boxes on the right are around sort of the support to the 16 service delivery areas. The first of those is the Office of Operations Support. And the comment I would like to make about that is that this is an area where we're looking at changing the role of this office. In the last 2 years, the Office of Operations Support has had a role of really being a funnel and a conduit for communications between central office and the field, and field and central office. What we'd like to do is really change that role where we either are stepping out of the way or we're facilitating those conversations, not being the funnel for them. So to do that, as a result of doing that, we expect to reduce the number of staff that we'll have in that Office of Operations Support. And then under the Office of Central Support, are those functions, quality control, investigations, and I think there may be one or two others, that are those staff that provide quality assurance and other services related to eligibility and the quality of the services we provide to clients.
Let's see if I follow your organizational structure, that in the field, through your 16 delivery systems, there is 4,534 field staff.
Correct? Madam Chair, between the 16 service delivery areas and the statewide processing center, there are 4,534 staff. The processing center has about 250 staff.
And they're at the field level? Are they at the central office level?
Well, they would. We look at them as being field level. They're in a central location at the Parkway building in Salem, handling the applications and cases that come in from around the state.
So in addition to that, then, if I look at, I'm looking at central office staff now, not the field activity, but that which relates to central office, then there's about 90 or 91 FTEs to support the 4,500 plus?
Madam Chair, that's correct. 17 of those are dedicated just to vocational rehabilitation.
Can you provide for me, before we did the reorg, what that would have looked like as far as central office staff and field staff?
Madam Chair, we could certainly reassemble the data that we had on the field service or field operations sections in each of the separate program areas and be able to give you that comparison.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. On page 16 or 6 is the map of the 16 service delivery areas. As you can see from this, five of the service delivery areas are single counties. That's Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Lane, and Douglas counties. Most of the balance are either two or three county areas. The smallest service delivery area in terms of staff is service delivery area 9, which is Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, Gillam, and Wheeler. They have 79 staff. And then next door is Multnomah County with just under 900 staff. Most of the service delivery areas have between 120 and 250 staff. And what I thought I'd do is just briefly give you a profile of three of the service delivery areas to get a sense of what those operations are. The first of those on page 7 is service delivery area 2, which is Multnomah County. Multnomah County is obviously the smallest county in the state, but also is the most densely populated, has just under 900 staff in the county. The largest, we have 15 offices. The largest office, we have a couple offices that have about 120 staff. The smallest offices have about 15 staff. The biggest challenges in Multnomah County are, number one is simply the volume of diverse clients that we see. In several of our self-sufficiency offices, which provide the temporary assistance to needy families, food stamps, child care, and jobs program services, it is common for them to see 250 to 350 clients a day coming through the office.
Jerry, before part of of the planning for the future and looking at integrated services was also to define the areas or geographical areas of the most need within a community and work towards, as leases become available and what have you, to place the services within those areas. Can you give me some kind of a status report on where that identification is?
Madam Chair, are you referring just to Multnomah County or across the state?
Well, across the state, recognizing that Multnomah probably is the largest, but I think the ultimate objective was that at some point we would get to where the facilities and the service delivery was where the needs were the most greatest.
Madam Chair, we've made progress in that goal of having services where clients are in several areas of the state, although the budget has actually constrained us in others. We've had plans, for example, in Multnomah County to open a Rockwood site, and because of the budget reductions, we've essentially abandoned those plans. In other areas of the state, they have been successful in opening small offices or satellite offices in more rural communities to improve access for those clients. But it would be an area overall that would require more dollars in order to open those additional offices if we were to have them wherever there was a need.
I guess I'll rephrase, because part of the instruction was not additional offices, but as leases become available and as the agency identifies within its data collection and looking at its mapping, and I thought that Cindy was in the process of putting that mapping together, that you would have a high concentration maybe somewhere, let's say in Northeast Portland or wherever, and you knew through the mapping that that's where your highest needs were for, let's say, and I'll pay my money, TANF and protective services or foster care outreach was there. So it would suggest to you that that's where you need to concentrate a certain amount of your emphasis. So when those leases became available, that the agency would be at least prepared to begin to move in that direction. That's,
Madam Chair, may we provide you a status report
okay,
on this?
Thank
back
you.
In research. Another one of the challenges in Multnomah County has just to do with the sheer volume of other agencies that the department tries to coordinate with, both the county services, local schools, the caring communities, as well as nonprofits. Multnomah County also has the largest number of advocates and probably the most active advocates in the state in both child welfare and self-sufficiency, and there is a considerable partnering that occurs with those advocates on an ongoing basis. Probably the greatest benefit for integration in the department in Multnomah County really has been that improved understanding and knowledge of what the other services are that are available. We have moved probably about 80 staff are co-located in a number of facilities so that, in fact, the department has offices where child welfare, self-sufficiency, and vocational rehabilitation staff are in the same office, and they are beginning to do some of that coordinated staffing for clients that are identified. But across the system, I think that
we have okay with sharing their counseling rooms.
We
understand that was a major issue.
Madam Chair, my understanding of it is the vocational rehabilitation has been an active partner with us in these, and we have found satisfactory facilities for those meetings.
Okay, Jared. Yes, Senator Carter.
Would you leave my district alone, Madam Chair?
Well, it wasn't just your district. It was an issue that you know, often we face, when certain entities within our agencies say that they have to have their own room with which to interview their clients and did not want to share. And I knew that was an issue with Folk Rehab. Multnomah County.
Did you hear what Mr. Burns just said? Multnomah County has probably one of the most the strongest activist community there is. Take that,
I just wondered if they had solved the problem.
I do have some concerns, Jerry, about your staffing patterns in Northeast Portland. I'm greatly concerned about it, and I had told Jean about it. I'm going to say it to you and Ramona. I'd like for you guys to look at the staffing patterns in Northeast Portland.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I agree. We have, and not just in Northeast, but it is certainly an area where we really need to look at what the caseload distribution is and what the distribution of staff is and what the trends have been.
Right.
That there have been significant problems around staffing.
Right. I have some great concerns, so I want to give you a chance to address them before, you know, making any more comments. So I would be interested in that.
Okay. Service Delivery Area 13 is three counties in northwestern Oregon, Union, Baker, and Wallowa County. There are 101 staff in Service Delivery Area 13 in three communities, La Grande, Baker City, and Enterprise. The biggest challenge in Service Delivery Area 13 is really services to clients based on distance and transportation problems. That's a fairly common problem in rural areas. The second problem that they identified is a challenge around recruiting qualified staff when positions become available. On the positive side, that partnerships develop quickly in rural areas, and there really is a real capacity to identify clients that are in common, to do coordinated case plans, and to have good communication on an ongoing basis as services are delivered to those families and individuals. In Service Delivery Area 7, which is Coos and Curry counties on the south coast, there are 173 DHS staff in seven offices that are in four communities, Coos Bay, Gold Beach, Coquille, Brookings, and then there's a satellite office in Port Orford. The biggest challenges in Coos Curry, again, are distance and transportation for access. The other challenge that they've had in Coos Curry is that historically has been one of the most depressed areas of the state economically, and that creates a higher rate of social problems that our department has to respond to. In terms of integration, again, as a smaller area, Coos Curry has developed fast and strong partnerships with over 30 agencies in the two-county area, and they have a very active system around identifying clients that receive multiple services and to get to coordinated case planning for those services and those clients. On pages 11, 12, and 13 are really the summary of the staffings that were caseloads and staffing for last biennium and this biennium and where we currently are. What I'd like to focus on is the staffing aspect of this and what it's been like in the field, that this may respond to some of the issues that Senator Carter has raised. In self-sufficiency, this is an area where we have continued to be understaffed based on the standards that are established. In order to respond to that, each SDA has developed their own approach, but in large part, for temporary assistance to needy families, what the service delivery area has intended to do is to categorize the cases, to break them into groups based on whether they're high, medium, or low cases that are in need of case management services. So those cases that would be in the high category would be families that come in that are victims of domestic violence or homeless or have multiple presenting barriers when they arrive in the office. Those that are medium levels of case management tend to be those that are active in our jobs program that require some ongoing contact. And then those that are low levels of case management service are families where there's a non-needy caretaker relative or non-citizen cases. The actual staffing in these tends to vary by service delivery area. I know that in Multnomah County, that for those cases where there is a low level of case management required, that we've actually established a staffing standard of around 1 to 250 rather than the 1 to 90 that would be indicated on this page. That allows us to actually lower the staffing standard to deal with those clients who have higher barriers. In food stamps, where the food stamp program has caseloads have nearly doubled over this biennium, that many of the service delivery areas have essentially broken the functions out so that they can handle more cases. So what typically happens is that families or individuals that come in to apply for food stamps will come into a local office, apply, go through the eligibility determination. Once their eligibility has been set, if they are eligible for food stamps and they have a fairly stable family situation or fairly stable income, then the case goes to a food stamp processing center, which is essentially a model that we took from the Oregon Health Plan statewide processing center, where oftentimes the average ratio would be about 1 to 500 to 1 to 600 cases per worker, but workers have specific functions that they do rather than carrying an entire caseload. So some workers will do nothing but answer the telephone all day to handle the questions that come in from clients.
Sarah Carter. Jerry, on page 11, non-public assistance food stamp only. Who's in that group?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, could you repeat that?
Under self-sufficiency food stamp household, non-public assistance food stamp only.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, these are those families that are not receiving, families or individuals not receiving temporary assistance to needy families.
So did we notice that after adopting the economy, layoff, job layoffs, and that kind of stuff? Was that what we're saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, this is a caseload that has been rising dramatically for the last, I think, 4 years.
That's big. Thank you.
Returning to sort of a discussion around the staffing, I want to talk a little about child welfare. And while the caseload fluctuation hasn't been as great in child welfare over the last 2 years, there have been other issues. And I think one of the primary ones is that there's been a significant distraction for child welfare workers as we have had a nearly singular focus around integration in the field. So there have been efforts around co-locating offices, around particularly the loss of branch managers in child welfare, the loss of support service supervisors and office managers, that have created problems for the line staff because they have not had the level of clinical supervision and counseling that they're used to as they have handled cases on a day-by-day basis that come through the local offices. I think that overall what I'd say about the staffing issues for service delivery areas and for local offices is that there have been a number of disruptions that we've created, and some of which have been very intentional, and that they have we've overcome the disruption because what we wanted to do was to create an office where staff were integrated, but recognize that there is some drop in performance while you go through the change of moving people from one office to another. They get reacquainted with a new workforce, sometimes a new supervisor and a new way of doing work. There have also been issues around the hiring freeze and the layoff that I don't have an exact number, but my understanding is we're around 1,300 vacancies that exist in the department today. Many of those, probably 800 to 900, are in the field, which creates a major workload for those staff who remain. The other problem that exists, and this is in part, I think, may respond to some of what you identified as problems in North-Northeast, Senator Carter, is that as vacancies develop, that the service delivery areas then need to begin shuffling positions that they do have so that there's fairly equal staffing across all of the offices that are there. And that comes with its own set of problems. While you may equalize the staffing, you create disruptions for the families that are affected. I think the other issue that exists for staff has been, well, I would say that in all sincerity, I have never ceased to be amazed by the staff we have in the Department of Human Services and the level of compassion and care that they provide to our clients. There are, however, those distractions that occur when you're looking at hiring freezes, when you've got reductions in the number of positions that are there and a very uncertain future. And there's a part of that that really does diminish people's effectiveness in their performance. And I think there's a part of that that we may suffer in these really hard days through the budget.
Jerry, I know that probably we're almost at 3, and I had hoped that we were going to get finished with today, but I see that we're not. And I hate to have you come back on Monday, but there's...
Madam Chair, I could actually wrap up in 5 minutes if you'd like.
Well, but my committee may have questions.
I have a rosy question, Madam Chair. What's a transfer AAA?
A transfer AAA?
Mm-hmm. And a contract AAA.
Well, it's the AAAs, you know, the area agency, you know, that's the AAA.
You're serious?
Uh-huh.
The what?
The Area Agency on Aging.
Oh, yeah.
So do you want to pay your money now?
No, I wouldn't. I want whoever prepared this document to pay.
Jerry pay money?
Jerry paid.
Oh, okay.
And so did Ramona.
Ramona always paid. I haven't seen Jerry here.
Well, Jerry, if there's no questions in this panel,
you missed Senator Carter. Oh, okay. It's here.
We can wrap up in 5 minutes. But if there's questions, and I didn't know how much that your detail, Jerry.
Can I finish?
Because I would, in case the members do have questions, because your presentation and what's occurring in the field is very important, and so I would not like to limit the discussion from this body. So I would just as soon as schedule you for to complete it on Monday, and then we can have both Pam and Sheila then do their wrap-up, too, on Monday. But we had hoped that we were going to get finished today, but we're not. So, but I would ask the body, we were late getting started today. It really helps if we can get started on time, because Sheila has us really boxed on time.
And sure, you know what? I think probably one of the things with this is with all caucuses caucusing.
Mm-hmm. You're saying we could have a lighter load on Tuesdays and Thursdays?
I think so, because today we were explaining where we were on OHP, and that's what saying that OHP.
Oh, okay. Y'all, I'll give up money. I was. and
Monday.
Sheila, maybe we can look at the Tuesdays and Thursdays schedule, but, you know, seriously, this is going to be a lot more intense as we start getting into their budgets and for the agencies to have to wait for we come, but I will try.
We would have to be more conscientious just to get here. Then.
To get here.
Yeah.
Right. So we were delayed considerably today, and Sheila's very good at timing us to assure that we finish her schedule. And as you know, the co-chairs have been very insistent that we get this job done in a fashion that they're applying pressure to me, so I guess I'm applying pressure to you.
We hear you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Well, with that, we will adjourn until Monday.